Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Okay, so can I start? People don't know when we're recording, but I just found out it's my guest's birthday. Happy birthday, Dennis.
Thank you so much. It really is a pleasure to be chatting with you. Thank you.
I am just so thrilled. I'm an August birthday. And I told a friend the other day, I'm like, who is also an August birthday. I said, I feel like when I find out people are August birthdays, I'm like, I knew it. There's something about us, I think.
Yes. Those summer birthdays, late summer too.
That's right. Late summer. So were you like the oldest in your class or the youngest in your class growing up?
I tended to be, I didn't even think about it that way, younger, because everybody seemed to be having their birthdays during the year. And I would be like, oh, my birthday's not coming until the summer. So yeah, it was younger. That's right.
Yeah. I graduated high school when I was 17, right? And so I, you know, turned 18 like a week or two before I started college.
Yep, exactly. Same.
Super weird. Yeah, it was super weird. But anyway, yes, we late summer birthdays. And right. I mentioned earlier, I had something going on my birthday and my kids were like, oh, mom, we'll celebrate. I'm like, listen, I was used to, we had to go enroll. It was like always on my birthday, you know, for school back at, you know, when I was a kid, I'm like, oh, it's your birthday. I'm like, what are we going to do? We're going to go enroll for school. I'm like, oh, yay.
Well, all the other kids would have parties in school or kids or moms bring cupcakes or something like that. You know, that never was true for a summer baby. Yeah. So that's okay.
That's right. It was good. It's good. So I'm thrilled that you're spending a little bit of your birthday with me. That feels really special. And we're going to chat about a book that you and Lisa Bowens have edited together.
That's right.
And the title of the book is Do Black Lives Matter? How Christian Scriptures Speak to Black Empowerment. Dennis, I feel like still this is, that title is a provocative title. Yeah. That title feels, unfortunately, it feels, you know, kind of loaded probably.
Yeah.
To some people. And I say that it's unfortunate. Maybe we can even start with that.
Yeah.
That your book title is a question.
Yeah. Thank you. It's funny because my adult children, they said, are people still really asking that question? And they said, well, maybe it depends on who's the intended audience. And I hadn't actually thought about it that way. I thought of it as, I mean, because Lisa and I wrestled back and forth with the title, and I thought of it almost as a sarcastic rhetorical question, like, do Black Lives Matter? Of course they do. You know, that's the way I thought of it. And the subtitle was really meant to say that the scriptures are telling us that Black Lives Matter. So, but we also wanted that phrase in the title. Because we know for some people it's triggering. For some reason, they find it necessary to counter it with, well, all lives matter, that kind of thing. And we wanted to make a pretty clear statement, even though we ask it as a question to draw you in. The book is a clear statement of response to that question.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. This book... I want to ask you about the why. Mm-hmm. When I was reading parts of it, I read your chapter, of mm-hmm. course, and then there are other places in the book, in the introduction, especially where you and Lisa reference the timing of this? What, you know, what was happening, you know, as you were writing, what was happening as ideas were coming in, what was happening even as the book was going to print? And so I feel like in some ways that is a little bit of an answer to the question, but where was the idea for this book birthed?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It took us a while to get it to come to fruition, because we started after the murder of George Floyd. Of course, the country seemed to be going through another sort of racial awakening or reckoning. And I think that was particularly acute in Christian circles. And for a variety of reasons, I think particularly evangelicals were trying... I can't speak for the whole group, of course, but it felt like people were trying to hold on to certain values that they've always held, but yet say, but I'm not racist, you know, and yet much in that sort of baked into the system was really racist. And so when after George Floyd was murdered, there were a lot of people asking for many Black Christians to speak at events or be on podcasts or be on panels or write books. And there was a lot of that happening, as if to say, okay, now we're ready to listen. So we said, we meaning a publisher and then Lisa and me, we were talking about how we could add our voices to this by saying, well, it's not just a quick response in the moment of crisis to something that's in the news cycle. This is something we've been thinking about, writing about, living for years. And it's an opportunity for us to now put that in a context, put what you're seeing in the summer of 2020 in a bigger context. And even though the book didn't come out like right after those events, we thought we maybe could get it together fast and it would come out in a few months. Unfortunately, what we say in there is still relevant. You know, even though we're past 2020, what we say, I think, will in the book will be relevant for, unfortunately, for quite a while. So yeah, it came about because of that time. And I mentioned George Floyd's murder, but of course there were so many events that were happening around the same time. There was like Ahmaud Arbery, there was people who felt free to, you know, attack a man on the street. There were people who were confronting Black people who weren't law enforcement, and then other cases where it was. So there was this whole sense of, my goodness, it's like the 50s and in the South in some instances. So we felt like this was a good time to speak up as Christian, as theologians, as biblical scholars, as practitioners, and sort of add our voices.
Yeah, thank you for that. Again, yeah, it's kind of like it is unfortunate that it is still extremely relevant. And as you mentioned, it will be for a while. The list of contributors in this book is, it kind of blows me away. I mean, who all has written for this, but you've got folks like yourself who are scholars and professors and pastors. And you cover kind of a big area of topics. So I don't know, maybe can you talk a little bit about kind of who you were able to get to contribute, and then like where you wanted them to write?
Yes, thank you. Well, it's interesting that we, now that we are still the publisher, Wiffenstock, Lisa and me, We were thinking we'd like this not to be just a series of academic essays by biblical scholars, although Lisa is a New Testament scholar as I am. So we knew, we thought right away, of course, about our discipline, but we said we don't want to just do that. We would like to hear from people who work, of course, in the Old Testament, and then also who think theologically about ideas. So we went after biblical scholars, theologians, in some cases, historians, like in the case of Vince Bantu, he's become a historian, even though I know his doctoral work was in Ethiopic. And he and others are, well, in many cases, our scholars are also practitioners. I mean, they're active in church life as well. And then we wanted to add the voice of preachers who reckon with these ideas on a more, I was going to say popular level, but on that day-to-day level, that's a little different than the way the scholars might approach it. So we've included sermons. So there's really three major sections. There's biblical analysis, Old and New Testament. There's theological, historical, and I would even say missiological analysis in the middle section. And then there's the voice of the preachers at the end. So that's how we arranged it. And it was grace of God that people responded. I mean, we talked to people that in some cases we didn't know really well, other people that we do know from academic associations and such. And it was really very wonderful when people said, yes, I'd like to contribute something. So we did not tell them what to write on, but we said, work in your discipline and just come with what you think fits this broad category of how the scriptures speak to Black empowerment. And it was wonderful to start seeing the essays come in as people, you know, took us back to the Old Testament, looked at prophetic witness, looked at, you know, Hagar's life. I mean, looked at so many biblical stories, narratives, people, and made connections to our time. And then to see people do that in the New Testament as well. And then for some who theologically like stepped back and looked at the big picture of what's been what we might say are theological ideas that have been at work in our world. It's hard to shout out some people. I don't want to highlight some without highlighting others. But I did think right away of Reggie Williams' essay, "A White Supremacy is a Script We're Given at Birth." I mean, his essay actually has appeared in a couple of places, but it's really a kind of a really, it's a remarkable study of how white supremacy is just embedded in our way of thinking. But to have a theologian come at that and highlight that was really, I think, very significant. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's
a little bit about how we got together. It's a little like, editing a volume with a lot of voices was harder than I realized it would be. But I'm just really delighted at the people who said yes to this.
Well, I know you don't want to shout out some and not others, but that's exactly what I was about to ask you to do, but not in like a necessarily a shout out way, but it's intriguing to me that you know, you're familiar with people's work, right? And mm-hmm. things that they have previously done, but then that you didn't ask specifically for them to write on a specific topic, just giving them the broader topic and saying, right, you know, give us something from your discipline. So that's actually what I was going to ask you is when some of those returned, were mm-hmm. there any, you know, maybe not necessarily surprises, but anything that you thought that, like, you know, maybe kind of helped you think about things in a new way or in a different way, or, you know, something that came back that maybe was a little bit different than what you were expecting?
That's an interesting question in terms of that, anything different. Maybe not different, but certainly more depth in certain areas than I, you know, was familiar with. There's, oh my goodness, it's hard to like I said, I don't want any essays to overshadow others, but I do think of some of our women scholars whose voices were muted for a long time. Just to put that in context, I'm getting older here. Of course, what you said is my birthday. Yeah, I'm getting really old, I sometimes think. But when I was a young scholar and just finishing up my doctorate, I mean, there were relatively few African-American scholars at all in the guild. I mean, just on a little side note here, I'll mention there was an article written in the 90s in the Washington Post, and I was in D.C., studying in D.C., and it was an article about how few African-American scholars there are in biblical studies particularly. And I think the article is entitled "African-American Scholars Find Their Way" or something like that. And it was in the Washington Post. But anyway, my point is there were so few, and of that number, very few women. So I'm happy to have the women's voices in this volume. And so I guess what I want to say is, in a general way, I was delighted by how many women scholars were willing to be in this. And I'm thinking right now of Jennifer Kalin's essay. She's another New Testament person. We have done work in the same parts of the Bible, the Catholic epistles, but she has an essay entitled "The Stories Our Bodies Tell: Black Bodies That Matter, Black Lives That Matter," and does a real interacts with contemporary literature, not all of it being biblical scholarship. I mean, she interacts with some contemporary popular literature, as well as doing good exegesis, deep work there, and raises some powerful questions of what the significance of the body. Toward the end, she goes, "To believe in the body is to believe in the possibilities of life. Dead and alive, bodies tell stories, if only we would listen." And something where I think many times in Christian circles, we've tended to either demonize the body or minimize it. And she does something really celebratory in that essay. And to say that about Black bodies is so empowering, when our bodies were used or somehow maybe objects of fantasy or something, but not valued. And so, yes, I found her essay one of those powerful ones.
You edited the volume, co-edited the volume with Lisa mm-hmm. Bowens, and right. you also contributed a yes. chapter. And so that's right. I do want to get to your chapter, but maybe mm-hmm. as we segue into it, I sometimes take for granted that what I spend 20 to 30 hours a week doing is studying. Right. So the MDiv is not a joke. And I spend a lot of my time, right, with my head in books, and I'm reading yeah. and writing sure. and reading and writing and talking about this kind of thing. And so sometimes I feel like I take that for granted, like, you know, isn't this everyone's day job? It's not everyone's day job, but it is mine. And one of the things that struck me as you began your essay, and I'm hoping that maybe you can take us there before we specifically talk about the topic of police brutality, which was the topic of your essay, is talk about the African-American hermeneutic. Mm-hmm. That this is not a monolithic lens for interpreting scripture, but there are some themes maybe yes, that yes. are present in an African-American hermeneutic. And so could you just help us kind of like maybe set the stage for us before we talk about your essay yeah. of some of the things that we might become more aware of if we are intentionally trying to utilize that lens?
Yes, I'll do that as briefly as I can, because it really is a deep topic and a rich one. You're starting to see many scholars, younger ones, who are writing more about from an African-American perspective without having to always say that it's an African-American. In other words, our voices are starting to get out there so we can just say who we are and do our interpretation from that lens. In fact, just the idea that we have a social location that flavors our interpretation is an idea that's catching on more and more. But it used to be, when I was younger, that no, there was just this one interpretation and you had to find it. It was like a detective hunt, like a Where's Waldo kind of a thing. You just had to find the right interpretation. So I would say that you're seeing, and I've written an essay on this elsewhere, I'll just acknowledge, in the new dictionary of Paul and His Letters, the second edition that InterVarsity Press has put out, I have an essay on African-American biblical interpretation, particularly as it relates to Pauline studies. But there are a few things. One is that central is the liberative way that we read the scriptures, meaning that we see the scriptures as for human flourishing, whereas in many times the scriptures were used as a weapon to marginalize some folks and to hold some people down, particularly African-American folks or non-Europeans. The so-called curse of Ham from Genesis, where Black people were told that, and I was even told that coming up, this is in the 20th century, that that God had ordained that we be slaves to white people. So the way the Bible was used, right, that way has created this, the need for a hermeneutic of suspicion, where we read and say, is this what the Bible's really saying in terms of the oppressive way that we've been treated? So African-American interpretation has a liberative kind of interpretation that looks to see God and see salvation from God as an act of liberation. The quintessential story is, of course, that of the Exodus, where God is on the side of the oppressed people, and salvation means deliverance from enslavement. So that kind of narrative fuels into our interpretation. We want to see all of humanity thrive, particularly those who've been on the margins. Another thing that African-American interpretation does is pay attention to the voices and the people that appear in the scriptures who aren't European. and many times you read the Bible and almost forget that we have so much African presence in the Bible. And to highlight that is something that we're drawn to. So a lot of times you'll see an African-American interpretation references to Africa itself and the highlighting of Africans. There are other streams with, I mean, other themes, I guess I could say, that emerge in our interpretation is there's a overlapping with the affirmation of women. So women as scholars, I would say, kind of overlap with, if you could do a Venn diagram thing, with some feminist ideas, African-American interpretation, of course. And so we see the same notions of flourishing, of liberation, of lifting up those on the margins, but particularly as it applies to women's voices. So those are the kinds of themes that you start to see emerging in our writing. And I would say it's, for some people, it's difficult because you'll find us questioning interpretations that people held on for a long time. And that becomes difficult for, let's say, white evangelicals to a large degree, because they hadn't heard those ideas questioned in the past, you know. And we will bring those questions because of the way we've seen the scriptures used to hurt and even oppress people. So that's some basics. I mean, I'm sketching in broad strokes, you know, but those are some things that emerge in African-American Bible interpretation.
Well, it's helpful. So thank you for doing that. Mm-hmm. I think when I first started studying, I was kind of taken aback. And I think that you're right. I have much less experience in education than you, but I think that you're right in that you're seeing scholars now just writing from their lens without necessarily having to explain mm-hmm. what the lens is. And when I first started studying, I really was kind of struck by this, what I was seeing as there's kind of like theology or even biblical studies, but I'll use theology like with a capital T, which mm-hmm. is kind of the white Eurocentric
right.
way of interpreting, and then or biblical studies. And then you have kind of everything else, right? Then you've got African-American theology or liberation theology or feminist theology or post-colonial theology. And all of these That's have right. lowercase, you know, in adjective words and lowercase
right.
T's, you know,
right.
and but still you've got this big, you know, capital T, which is, you know, I think that's what I thought of when you said there's kind of this one interpretation. It's kind of like a Where's Waldo, and you have
right.
to find it because
exactly.
it's this one way to look at it.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things I just want to mention really briefly, because you mentioned Hagar, and I haven't read the essay that mm-hmm. references Hagar, but it was a few years ago, I think, when I was starting to kind of practice my theological imagination and
yeah.
reading, you know, perhaps from different perspectives. But
right.
I kind of had this like moment. It was just in my normal like devotional time, and I was in Genesis and I'm reading through this mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, and of course, now I can look back and say I hadn't read a lot of the womanist scholars who've been pointing this out mm-hmm. for decades.
Yeah.
But when I did read them on Hagar, it affirmed what I felt like I was experiencing in my devotional, you know, where it was like this, why hadn't I seen that before? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and I'll just like kind of be blunt. What I saw in that moment was like, why had I not seen Sarah as an oppressor before? Right. Yeah, like why had I never, you know, never seen this? Or, you know, getting to practice in a biblical interpretation class of putting myself in the shoes, just trying to empathize with a character and choosing Bathsheba for an essay. Right.
Yeah,
and saying,
right.
Oh my goodness, I'm reading through this. And guess what? If I were in a play and I was Bathsheba, I would have no dialogue.
Right, right.
I would have no scripted words, you know,
example.
In this,
good example.
You know, in this scene, you know, what, mm-hmm. how does that feel, you know, as a right. woman, as a person, you know, who doesn't even have a voice, you know, in this, in this scripture passage. And so, I just want to say it can be, I think, as you mentioned, difficult for some folks who aren't used to hearing those perspectives, aren't used to reading, you know, the scriptures from different perspectives than maybe right. this kind of Eurocentric white capital theology T. Mm-hmm. But that this is, it's not just helpful. Anything I say here sounds like so diminishing, but it's like this. Like, we need each other.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
read the scriptures.
Amen. We need each other. And I'm certainly an advocate of that each other being really broad. But in many cases, you know, I'm going to respect my own context as an African-American for many years. I mean, I think back to my seminary years as well as then my doctoral study years. There was not almost an expectation. There wasn't an expectation that your social location mattered in interpretation, right? And so I would say we still need each other, but we particularly need those who haven't been heard from.
Amen.
You know?
Yeah.
So I want to shout out at this point my colleague or my co-editor, Lisa Bowens, because I came to know her through some professional associations, but in her written work, particularly her recent book, African American Readings of Paul, she puts a liberative lens on Paul's writings, which for many African Americans is hard to do.
Yes. I mean,
because particularly those household codes, and Paul seemed to be oblivious to the realities of slavery. So I mean, he's a citizen, he's enjoying his rights, which I guess relates to my essay, which we can talk about. But I want to particularly shout out Lisa because she's gone back to the writings of enslaved or people who had just come out of slavery. So we're going back to 17th, 18th, 19th century. And she's talking about people who saw their own call to ministry in Pauline writings. So Paul's writings empowered them to live in a way that often countered what they were experiencing from the dominant culture's practice of Christianity. So to me, that is another example of how this liberative lens says, you know, even though some of the Christian teaching came from enslavers, or at least the people that they represented, Black people still came to see that faith in God could be a liberative experience, and it didn't have to look like what was happening to them. I mean, classically, we know, I mean, now it's popular with memes and stuff to hear the voice of Frederick Douglass in that the slavery that was practiced by the enslavers is not the Christianity of Christ, you know, that he makes this contrast. Well, we're seeing that in people who then accepted calls to do ministry, who went out preaching, went out teaching, who put their lives on the line in many cases, and even stood up to male authority in the case of many women to live out this calling. And they got it from reading Paul, which for some people is like, wait, really? From reading Paul? So their eyes on Pauline texts led to different conclusions than some white people's eyes on Pauline texts. And I think that's something it's really worth noting. So that's one reason why we need each other. We see these empowering passages for people whose voices got muted.
Yes, yes, that's really important. I think as as a woman, I sit back when you said this, reading Paul in a liberative way, and I thought, you know, immediately, of course, thought of what you just referenced, of that you know, that was a difficult thing for many people, African Americans, to think, even think about reading Paul with a liberative lens, but that's also for many women, you know, for the, you know, many of the same passages, household codes and things like that. That feels really encouraging, that we can read, Paul's text from a liberative lens. And on that, I do want to dig into your chapter. Because you look at a text in Acts that is not a Pauline text, but Paul is there.
That's right.
he's a character in this.
That's right.
In this story. And we do know these things about Paul. Paul was a citizen. He did not shy away from, you know, using that fact when he interacted with authorities. So maybe can you set the stage for us, not just these few verses that you really focus on, but kind of this whole scene of what got this is Paul and Silas get thrown in jail.
Right.
So what's the I even want to use the word reason loosely, I'm like, what? Okay, so what happens here? Because they end up in jail. It's arguable that they shouldn't be there in the first place. But what happens with them?
Well, yeah, thank you. You know, this text has always been a thing for me, and I'm not a Lucan scholar per se, but I've been intrigued at how little I have found people interact with what happens after the conversion of the jailer. But the story is well known in some Christian circles. I mean, there's songs about it and all, but when Paul and Silas are ministering in Philippi, at least according to Luke's account in Acts, mostly chapter 16 here, the two of them are going around doing ministry, and there's a woman who's enslaved and used to making money because she also has this power to kind of be a soothsayer. And she's going around saying these men are from God. The text actually says he has a python spirit, which is actually a whole ancient thing. But the point is they're making money off of her and she's enslaved. And what she's saying isn't necessarily wrong or incorrect, but somehow it bothers Paul that it's coming out of her mouth. So he casts the spirit out of this woman, who, which then means that a loss of income for those men who have been enslaving her. I'm laughing because we don't always think of the story in economic terms, but that's really the issue. Their money machine had just dried up. And so there's all kinds of pressure now on the community to get Paul and Silas out of there, and they throw them in jail. They actually beat them and throw them in jail. And it's in jail that we have the beautiful and powerful story of this earthquake at midnight while Paul and Silas are praying and singing hymns to the Lord. And the chains fall off of everybody in the earthquake, but nobody escapes. The jailer's going to kill himself. And Paul says, no, we're all still here. The jailer asks those questions, what must I do to be saved? And it's this beautiful story of conversion. So jailer, we often translated jailer. I translated it warden, in line with one of my doctoral professors, Joseph Fitzmyer, translates that way better. Warden, somebody who's overseeing the whole jail situation. And he gets converted and takes care of Paul's wounds. And we usually end the story right there because it's such a beautiful story of conversion that in evangelical circles, that's our main point. We want to highlight that somebody got converted even in these odd circumstances. But Luke continues the story, and he tells us that on the next day, the magistrates say that Paul and Silas can go. So the warden says to them, look, you can go in peace. The magistrates, they're letting you go. And Paul then gets agitated. And in essence, he says, peace? They beat us publicly without a trial. And he starts to then assert his rights as a citizen and to speak up. Now, we don't know if he was doing this before. I mean, Luke doesn't tell us that maybe he stood up for his rights before or something, but we don't know. I mean, he certainly ended up in jail. But here he's making a fuss when he has the opportunity to go out. And the magistrates then are really agitated because they've broken the law by having Paul whipped without a trial, Paul and Silas whipped without a trial. So they want him to just get out of town quietly. But that episode said a lot to me, partly, and I'm not the only one who thought of it this way, although I tried to do a little bit different than Willie Jennings. And his Acts commentary, he mentions this encounter as well. And it raises questions about what we think about imprisonment and justice. Now, I also want to put here in context, Alexis, what what motivated me to look at this passage is the way that it, for me in my lifetime, I've heard white Christians particularly get upset with Black Christians for protesting, for even getting together and raising their voices against injustice, even though in most cases we are citizens. And so for one, for some of them, just the fact of protesting is not a thing a Christian should do, or at least that we Christians shouldn't do. And then also the assumption that anybody who's in prison is there justly or rightly, or because they deserve to be, if just to borrow the kind of language I've heard. So I wanted to deal with that. We've got two people who are thrown in jail for their faith, and it's questionable whether they ought to be in jail. And then they protest their jailing. So they do the very things that I've heard people, I mean, they do the opposite of the things that I've heard people talk about in evangelical circles. So I wanted to highlight that in my essay.
Yeah, thanks for setting that stage there, because there are so many questions that I, you know, kind of have, you know, just swirling around in my mind. But I kind of want to go back to the beginning of that passage where you say we don't talk about the economics of that. But what we've got is kind of you've got someone who had some privilege because he is enslaving this woman. Yes. And so he has some privilege, he has some power, he has some money, he has some influence, it seems, because it's kind of, you know, his fussing that is, you know, that is influencing this. And I don't think it's in the same section that you reference it in your essay, but that brings my mind to the encounter between Amy Cooper and and I've lost his first name.
They're both Coopers, though.
Both Coopers, and he's bird watching, right? The park, and some people may not remember what we're referencing, but basically, as I remember the story, they're both bird watching in the park. He asks her just simply if she could mind leashing her dog.
That's right.
And then she, which is one of the rules in the park. In the city, and she, whatever, she becomes offended, I guess, to the point that she decides to call 911. I think not even just, you know, the regular police number, and insists that there is a Black man threatening her.
That's right. That's right. It was Christian Cooper is the guy.
Christian,
that's right.
Thank you, Christian. Yes.
Well, you do mention, I actually do mention that in my essay, because that story really, that encounter that, and it was in the news, really bothered me. I've since done some reading because Christian Cooper has written about this in other places. So I heard him in an interview. He's got a book out, actually, because he's a Black bird watcher, which he already thought he was kind of an outlier in that. But yeah, it's just the way that this woman was ready to use the police as a weapon. Because she knew that if she claimed that she was a victim of this Black man, that the police would likely believe her. So there was something scary about this for me as a Black man, that somebody could simply say that they're being threatened and use the police in a sense as a weapon. So I feel like that. Yeah, I mean, that really it bugged me a lot when that happened in the news. I think when you talk about the power and privilege that goes with that, you're right to connect that to the merchants there in Philippi, that because of their social position, they could say, look, these two guys are causing trouble. It gets the whole town in an uproar and gets the police on them. And actually, it's interesting, the word for the what we translate sometimes as police or as the guards or authorities, I forget how it's translated in some places, but it's literally the rod men. Yeah, so they came with rods to beat people, which in some ways is, we haven't evolved all that much further. You know, we expect the police to come in with their sticks and to beat on people that they perceive as the wrongdoers in the situation. So yeah, I think these men, these merchants in Philippi called on their privilege in the same way this Amy Cooper called on hers, and the police become a vessel or a tool in that. This is not to demonize police work, but it's to say the way our society has operated is that it's easier for people in privilege to see the police as allies, and people who don't have privilege to see the police as frightening.
Yeah, for sure. And that reminds me how you even begin your essay. The first line, the first sentence of your essay could be seen as controversial, right? I mean, you begin with, I'll just read this first sentence, sure. but because you begin with those who profess faith in Christ, mm-hmm. right? Those who profess faith in Christ ought to lend their voices and energy to transforming law enforcement, including policing, rather than maintaining the status quo. And yeah. I agree with that. It's a blanket statement that I agree with, mm-hmm. but this statement, and I think the truth in that statement has not been received by mm-hmm. all who profess Christ, especially in the US, especially after mm-hmm. the events of the policing events of 2020.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, again, if the system seems to work for you, then you don't want to change it. And if the system seems to, you have a lot of Christians who will quickly run to Romans 13, that the authorities exist because they're ordained by God. Yet, as our friend Esau Macaulay has written in his book, you know, Reading While Black, he deals with that passage in Romans 13. I mean, the authorities aren't there just to punish the oppressed. You know, that's not their role. But we tend to give them this carte blanche to be the we assume that they're in the right. And I'm not trying to demonize law enforcement. I know people work in law enforcement, but the point is to say that there's some issues in the system, and we've been seeing it all across the country. And now, and more recently, of course, since the book has been written, the reports have come out of Minnesota that talked about the Minneapolis Police Department and a sort of a systematic, built into the structure, racism that treated dark-skinned people poorly for years. So what we saw with George Floyd was horrible, yet at the same time, it's indicative of things that were already going. So I would say Christians should be like, whoa, the first ones to say, let's fix this. Right. And instead, I'm often hearing evangelical Christians say, look, we don't know the whole story. You know, it's the few bad apples. It's the maybe he really did something. Look, I mean, I would almost wager money that if a white guy, you know, showed a sketchy looking $20 bill, he wouldn't have been killed in the street. So there's something about the system that needed to be changed. And I felt like the scriptures give us, for those who profess Christ, who say, well, the Bible doesn't say X, Y, Z. I want to say, well, actually, maybe it does. And some of what it's saying should prompt us to think in terms of how we order our society even today.
yeah. No, I completely agree. I mean, let's go back to that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of ignored part of the story after mm-hmm. the conversion happens. You know, I think that you alluded to it earlier, but I'm going to ask you to say more, because one of the responses, and you kind of list some of these, and you did earlier too, some of these responses to either Black Lives Matter or let's look at police reform even. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of those, when folks start saying, look, we can really look at the scriptures, or the scriptures have something to tell us about that. And then the response sometimes is, well, I think you should just preach the gospel.
Yeah, that's been much of my life. I mean, I think I won't take this conversation in a different direction. But when I got really fed up with the way white evangelicalism was operating, and I was around 40 years old, about 20 years ago, and I just gave up. I mean, I didn't want to read any more stuff. Wasn't reading Christianity Today. I wasn't reading all the popular evangelical stuff because I just got tired of it. I felt like for all the energy I put in, and this would be now going back to the 90s, all the language of racial reconciliation and all the seminars I was in, all the panels I was part of, all the times churches I spoke at, all of these things I had done as a young man in my 30s, I was like seeing it appeared that there was hardly any change. And what I was seeing was the white power structure in evangelicalism was just going to keep business as usual. But every now and then there would be some black voices that co-signed on what they would say. So those people got big platforms and got pushed in front because for whatever reason, I don't know what's in people's minds, but they would represent a minority voice among black people, and they got the big platforms. So I just got really tired of it. So for me, it was I you know my scholarship was starting to come out. I was just finishing up my doctoral study, so I thought, well, this is the way I think. But then I started to realize there were other people who thought this way too, right? So anyway, I just wanted to put that all in the context that for me, it became important to say, we who have been not been able to add our voices to this mix actually do have something to say, and it's still rooted in the same scriptures, right? It's still that we're working with these same texts, and that to me was the important thing, is to say, I would hear people criticize and say, well, those are like sociological arguments, or you're making political kind of arguments. And I'm saying, well, I think the text is pushing us in a certain direction, or at least we could see it that way and not minimize the positions that had not been popular in white circles, like protest and such. I mean, just as we're on this topic, I mentioned also, when Colin Kaepernick took a knee and didn't stand during the national anthem as when he was still playing football, and how he got framed as being anti-American or anti-military or not patriotic, which of course it was nothing that he was even saying. And then after George Floyd was murdered, you had the NFL then sort of trying to backpedal and say, support, trying to play now the Black National Anthem at the games, things, these performative kind of things without actually addressing the structure. So white Christians were complicit in this, that they also co-signed on the negative trash talk about Colin Kaepernick, rather than saying, wait, if he's talking police brutality, let's explore that. I mean, as Christians, let's look at that and say, maybe he's got a point. And but not enough of that happened. I'm not even
No,
sure I answered your question at this point.
it's good.
Got
No, it's good.
carried away.
No, I appreciate it. I love it when guests get carried away. It's my favorite. But yeah, it's this. We were yes to everything you said.
Okay.
Yes, and amen to everything you just said. But going to the part after the conversion is
Oh,
what made me
yes.
think of it. And I wasn't explicit in that, but that's what made me think of it. This kind of just preach the gospel. It's kind of like, well,
Oh,
this guy got
yeah.
saved, right? So
Right,
what's the
right.
problem, right? You know,
Right,
like
right.
you're like,
Thank you.
okay, well, here's the deal. This
Yeah.
guy gets saved and it's great, but Luke feels like
Right.
maybe we should hear what
Yes.
happens, you know, what happens after the fact. And why is Paul mad, or why is he even, you know, like I think that's part of it. When you start looking at it and you go, well, I mean, he got free, right? They tell him he can leave.
Right,
It's
right.
fine. And Paul really insists that this isn't the way the system should be
That's
set
right.
up,
That's right.
and really insists that they own it.
That's right. Exactly. Thank you. Well, you summarized well what I'm trying to say there. That's exactly right. And yes, and you put it nicely in that context of the folks who say just preach the gospel. I actually hadn't thought about that when I wrote it, because that's the other thing that I've heard so much in my life, just preach the gospel, as if we would solve all the issues of race and power and privilege and class and so forth in our society, when clearly, Luke, I would say clearly in this case, like you said, Luke didn't think that was where we should end the story with the conversion of this jailer, that we needed to see Paul speaking up as a citizen. Now, I admit that I don't want to make arguments from silence. I admit I wish he would have done the same thing about slavery. So that does lead to some questions about the fact that his privilege as a citizen allowed him to maneuver in certain ways. And for some, that's the only point of Paul bringing out his citizenship, is to show us that he could, you know, propagate the gospel more freely. He can move about more freely. But I think there's something also at play about the way authority should work and the way power should work that comes up in these verses. But it also maybe hints at why, even in the situation with the woman that he cast the demon out of, I mean, she's free of that spirit, but we don't know about her social position in there. That's not something Luke tells us about. So again, I would say not just me, but other people, women and other minoritized scholars would pay attention to that too and have some questions about what does that say? So they would interrogate that too. So it's so for us, that preaching the gospel part, while that's powerful, that's not all that it means to preach the gospel. It's not just seeing the jailer and his household converted. It's seeing the jailer also confronted with an unjust system, you know, and Paul confronts that system right in front of him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that does open up, you know, quite a bit, and we definitely don't have time to go there at this moment, but, right. You know, it's a conversation I'd love to, you know, have over coffee sometime, but it's this, you know, how we, you know, kind of this idea of even Christians, how are we reading the Bible? How are we taught to read the Bible? What are we taught it is? What does it include? What does it not include? Right. So Paul does not say these things about slavery, but does that silence say something or not? You know, I think, you know, the example I use frequently is my husband is a research geologist, PhD in geology, right? And so it's like, you know, we've had folks even asking, like, people have asked me, like, is he saved? You know, because it's like he's an earth scientist, right? And so he must not be, because, know, he doesn't, you know, subscribe to this, you know, maybe young earth, six-day kind of thing. But, you know, again, it's like, what are we taught that the Bible even is? Is it to have all of the answers for everything question that we might ask that might come up in 21st century society? No. Does it, if we're attuned, give us some ideas about how to love each other well, how to interact with authority and things like that? Yes. Does it give us all of those answers? I don't think so. Right. So I think that, you know, some of those that are kind of much bigger questions, but I do want to kind of throw out A, because I love talking about it, and B, you know, just for folks who might be listening, of like, you know, you spent a little bit of time, thank you very much for doing that, on some aspects of an African-American hermeneutic. But I just think we all probably could, it would do us all good to re-examine our own lenses every once in a while, at least, right? You know, what have I grown accustomed to? How have I grown accustomed to reading this? And what might it be doing? How might it be forming me?
Well, I say amen to that. And also, I mean, just to be able to question, or bring questions to the Bible. I was not taught that as a kid. It's like the Bible is only the answer book. You don't bring questions. You don't question it. Because that would seem to be like you're questioning God's authority, right? But one of the scholars also who's in this book, Angela Parker, she does a really good job of giving us the freedom to ask questions of biblical texts. And it forces us to pay attention to context, which in my upbringing, there wasn't a lot of that. There was, you know, you saw the words in black and white, and back then it was King James words. And then you sort of made this quick leap to the 20th century, my time period coming up, and made what we thought were the applications those verses should have in our lives without paying attention to context. And I would say all the biblical scholars, you know, I think would agree with me that yes, context, but I know Dr. Parker thinks that way because I've interacted with her on other things, Angela Parker, but she's done, she does a good, I think her essays on Romans. Yeah. And she, again, takes us back to context, but also allows us to ask questions of biblical text. So that's a hermeneutical approach that some of us were cautioned against. But minoritized scholars do this. I mean, that's part of a hermeneutic of suspicion, not to say that the Bible should make us suspicious, but we become suspicious of the way the Bible was used. So we start to ask questions about the Bible. Does it say this? Or what is going on here? And it kind of pushes us back to some things. And yes, the Bible is not going to give us all the kind of answers that might satisfy us in our 21st century time. Like I wanted Paul to say more. I mean, there's a prominent scholar, a white scholar, who said, pretty straight out. He said Paul was blind, he said, to the immorality of slavery. And that's a pretty strong statement. But he's willing to say, that scholar's willing to say, Paul didn't put, you know, slavery in a moral category, you know, because it was sort of just a functional thing that he lived within a society. To me, that's a shortcoming. And but at the same time, it doesn't make the scriptures be any less helpful for us. But it does mean that Paul lived in a world, maybe had a frame of reference that was short-sighted. Now, for some people, that's sacrilegious. And I get why people feel that way. I understand. But I do feel like we're allowed, and I've felt that increasing freedom over the years to say I'm allowed to interrogate how the Bible's been used and how it was functioning in its time, and what is it really meant to do. So I kind of more what you were saying earlier, what is its job?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. I feel I think it's important for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe folks like me who are rules followers, there may or may not mm-hmm. be other people out there who are like that, but it feels good to have that permission. You know, mm-hmm. I kind of started delving into those waters several years ago of maybe it's not that I need all the kind of quote right answers, but maybe I could just ask some decent questions, maybe some better questions, or maybe questions at all. So it feels really good to have a biblical scholar say, yeah, this is not just permissible, right? But this is helpful, and it can increase intimacy with God, I think, and it's formative, and, you know, all of those things to ask questions of the text and ask questions mm-hmm. of ourselves as well.
Yeah.
Dennis, as we start to wrap up, I just mm-hmm. want to, I just want to give you opportunity. Usually what I love to ask professors is, what's the question that I didn't ask?
Yeah.
So I feel like I can see it on their faces. You know, it's like, oh, if somebody would just raise their hand and say this, that I could really riff, you know, what I want to riff on. So, yeah. So what's the question that I didn't ask of you?
In this case, one does not come readily to mind. I think the thing I really wanted to stress, and it's come through, I think, but I'll say it again, is how much that we are looking at a biblical, ethical, historical, missional kind of framework to look at the power that the scriptures are demonstrating and yielding and giving to marginalized people, particularly African Americans in this case. And that we're not coming at it as merely, you know, secular sociologists or something, which is not a bad lens, but that's not our lens. Our lens is a biblical one. So I really wanted to stress that our work is not trying to push a political agenda per se, but it's trying to say, you know, that the Bible is giving us voice and agency. So that's the thing I wanted to stress. But you already touched on that, and I can't think right now of anything else, but I want to push how that there's a multitude of voices in this collection. And I really want to encourage people to read the whole thing, because you'll get a taste of different scholars and different practitioners.
Yeah, for sure. And I will link the book in the notes, as well as we have a lot of resources that we mentioned. So I will link as many of those as I noted and as I can find. And I'll also just say on these voices, I'm so thrilled to have this as a reference. A couple of folks have been on the podcast, so I'm going to link their episodes too.
Good.
People can hear them talk on other things. I'm looking specifically, Vince Bantu has been
nice.
On and Brian Bantam.
Oh,
too,
nice.
Came on with Gail. Okay. So yeah. So I'll link their episodes, because they talk, you know, Brian talked about marriage and Vince talked about, And Vince talked about, I'm trying to think if where we went in that episode. I think it was Christianity beginning in Africa.
He's become a specialist on the African origins of Christianity, and he touches a bit about on that in his essay in this book too.
So that'll be so great. Thank mm-hmm. you again. Thank you. Dennis, happy birthday.
Yes, thank you so much, Lexis. I appreciate it.
And this is, again, Do Black Lives Matter? How Christian Scriptures Speak to Black Empowerment. Thank you so much for coming on and talking.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.